I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio in San Antonio, and this is Fronteras, a program about issues along the U.S.-Mexico border and changing demographics in the Southwest. Name-calling, teasing, bullying. It often starts off innocently enough, but it could lead to dire consequences. How does one learn compassion? One San Antonio teacher is incorporating tolerance and acceptance into the classroom through lessons of the Holocaust. Lisa Berry is a teacher of 5th grade English language arts and social studies at Woodridge Elementary in San Antonio's Alamo Heights Independent School District. She was recently honored by the Jewish Federation of San Antonio as the first recipient of the Maxine Cohen Hope for Humanity Educator Award for her efforts to spread a message of love and support for humanity. Berry joins us on Fronteras, along with Ellen Olervides, Community Relations Council Director and Director of the Holocaust Memorial Museum of San Antonio. Berry tells us she was inspired to start the course when reflecting on one instance in her youth, when she was a bystander to a school tragedy.
Many, many years ago, I had some issues in my classroom where I was seeing a repetition of an event that had taken place in my early years where we lost a student in my very small high school to suicide. And there was lots of bullying, lots of things going on. He didn't feel he fit in, and other kids wanted to accentuate those differences. And when I became a teacher, I saw that from the perspective of the teacher. I went to my counselors and I said, I see potential for terrible things happening in the future of this child and the ones who are perpetrating against him, as well as the bystanders. And I was a bystander in high school, and I have never forgotten being a bystander. I did not forget going back into that classroom the day after and his empty desk sitting there, knowing I did nothing. I did nothing. And I can't go back and rewrite the past, but I can certainly prevent that from happening in the future. I don't feel I am that powerful, but I feel like when you grow your groups of children into a bystander group, then you do have some power. And so I noticed these things going on in my classroom, and I asked the counselors. I said, I need something that can touch these kids. And a counselor handed me a little video that was about the Holocaust and Anne Frank. The kids started doing a research project. They were each assigned a child from the Holocaust. And so what was going to be a two-day lesson ended up being a five-month lesson. And they were to bring that child's story to life, a story that was not to be told, a story that was supposed to be snuffed out, a face that was never to be seen. You know, you can throw a pebble in the pond, and those ripples are going to go out. It's up to you what kind of pebble you throw into the pond. Are you going to throw a pebble of hatred in the pond and have it affect all of those around you? Or are you going to throw something good into this world and let it ripple out and affect more people? Because the more people it affects, the more people they will affect.
Did you notice when you were giving these lessons to your students that maybe some of the ones who had the potential to be bullies or already were bullies, did you sort of see their attitude change during the course of the class?
Absolutely. We're all the same. We've all experienced those feelings of jealousy, and how do you react to jealousy versus how should you react to jealousy, or how should you react to feeling less inferior than someone, and how do you handle it the next time that happens to you? Making them cognizant of their feelings, and the more cognizant of their feelings, the more they're going to be cognizant of their reactions to their feelings. And so I did have kids who even said in front of television cameras, they said, I've bullied and I've seen what it can do, and I didn't think it was that big of a deal because it was just, you know, an elbow here in the hall or an unkind word, you know, whispered behind someone's back. But I now see that there are ramifications and there are consequences. And they would admit to it, and they would come to me and they'd say, I see in myself all these kinds of people. I've seen where I've been a bystander. I've seen where I've been a perpetrator. But I've also seen where I've been a victim, too, and so I know how they feel.
Well, Ellen, the Holocaust is a very difficult subject. What does the Holocaust Museum do in order to educate young people of the age of Lisa's students?
At the museum, we make every effort to connect students to events that they can understand. For instance, what are people doing in this picture? What is happening at this point in the timeline through the museum that connects you to, say, American history? Helping them to make connections about civil liberties, about civil rights, about alienation and marginalization. It's a common feeling that everyone has had, feeling on the outside, looking in. Most children can recall, even as they become adults, moments in their childhood where they felt hurt, harmed, whether intentionally or not. There is a film that breaks my heart every time I see it. This woman is recounting what it was like for her as a little girl. And she comes home from school and tells her parents, after they see her having scrubbed her flesh raw, having been at school that day, she'd been called a dirty Jew. And children are so literal. So this young girl comes from school and doesn't really understand the implications of such words, but wonders, if she bathes every single day, how can someone think she's dirty? There's so many things to think about. As an adult, you think about, where did she hear that? And you know that those are adult words. Those are adult feelings that a young person heard. Because most children don't sense or feel those things naturally. They're open and they're wonderful and wondrous and they are accepting and loving. So what are those outside forces too that change the way young people feel about one another? And so in the museum, there's an image of a woman sitting by herself on a bench that says, Jews only. Children can connect that to American history, segregation. Then we talk about, have you ever felt alone? What does that feel like? How can we help each other not feel alone? Invite someone to sit with you at lunch or greet someone, you know, warmly who may be a stranger in your midst. We look at perpetrators, we look at bystanders, but we also look at people who do the right things, people who sacrificed and risked their own safety to do what was right, people who fought government, fought institutions, and really set an example for what does one do when faced with such unbelievable circumstances. How are you a human being? What I think is special about Lisa in her program is that we can teach young people what it's like to organize for good. What does it look like to be a really good human being, you know, with heart and love and consideration and empathy? Something that seems to be lacking is just empathy. Maybe it's just easier to turn a blind eye. Maybe it's easier to remain silent, but at what cost? And I think that the stories and the experiences that are taught through this lens, focusing on the Holocaust, it provides a lens for looking at human behaviors and actions and deeds, not just of governments and institutions, but of citizenry. And then looking at that, how can we then work diligently to maintain our civil liberties and to defend those whose liberties are at risk?
The museum chose to award Lisa with the Maxine Cohen Hope for Humanity Educator Award. And Lisa, the award sort of made your efforts even more justified.
Absolutely. I've always known that it's a good thing. I've always known that, you know, really delving into Black history during February and anti-slavery movements and then Holocaust during the rest of the year, I've always known that that really creates a connection with the kids because it's a heart connection. And when you get them at this young of an age, you really do have a little bit more influence over, you know, kind of molding their hearts. You know, their parents are doing an awesome job at home, but, you know, at school, you also want to continue to help mold and meld their hearts. And they're at just the most perfect, ripe age to teach that because they're still connecting. They have younger siblings. They see these children of the Holocaust, these faces, and they're like, oh gosh, this one's so little. He's the same age as my baby brother. And that would be terrible. I didn't even think about, like, last night we just had dinner and never thought about the fact that we never worried that somebody was going to come in and end our dinner. But you can't forget what happened in the past. And I love the fact that they connect with it, with their own family. It does justify, it does make me feel like, yes, I'm doing the right thing. It's not a single person effort. I cannot do this on my own and never have done this on my own. I have the support of the parents. I have the support of my team and my school admin. It really couldn't be done without the foundation, who grants the money to make these things happen, because there's supplies that are needed. And we fly in a Holocaust survivor who is an international tolerance speaker. We fly her in from New York every year. I'm very blessed, and I'm extremely humbled to have gotten the very first Maxine Cohen Humanitarian Award. I just keep thinking to myself, that's what I needed. I am not driving this vehicle blindly, that I have so many people around me guiding me and keeping me on the right path, and the path to helping children and helping our future generations to understand each other and be more accepting and tolerant of each other.
We've been speaking with Lisa Berry, who teaches fifth grade English language arts and social studies at Woodridge Elementary in San Antonio's Alamo Heights ISD. She was recently honored by the Jewish Federation of San Antonio as the first recipient of the Maxine Cohen Hope for Humanity Educator Award. We also spoke with Ellen Olervides, Community Relations Council Director and Director of the Holocaust Memorial Museum of San Antonio. Coming up next, a Garland, Texas artist used comics as a way to escape his abusive childhood.
If I didn't like the ending to a comic book, I would do the whole thing from scratch and change the ending. And sometimes, like, the villain would be my dad and, like, Spider-Man's rescuing us and stuff like that.
That's still to come on Fronteras. Stay with us. Welcome back to Fronteras. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio in San Antonio. There's an ongoing crisis in Myanmar, formerly Burma, caused by violence against Rohingya Muslims. Many call it genocide. That's led to an exodus of hundreds of thousands of people. Some Rohingya now call North Texas home. Pablo Peña reports.
Shahida Winton lost her parents when she was 13.
My father and mother died. And Burmese
That was almost 30 years ago. Winton escaped the violence and ended up in Texas through a refugee resettlement program. But she struggles with English. Where Winton grew up, education is forbidden, especially for women.
Don't understand English, don't read in, don't write in, and very problem.
That's why the Islamic Circle of North America in Dallas holds ESL classes, English as a second language, for Winton and other women like her, so she can perform daily tasks like shopping for food.
Shopping and don't talk, don't understand, very problem. I come in and yes, in class and talk a little bit, very happy.
More Rohingya refugees have been moving to North Texas over the past few years for job opportunities and a supportive Muslim community. And many of them turn to the Islamic Circle. Zaid Hussein is the director of the Islamic Circle. He says a few years ago, they didn't serve many Rohingya refugees.
But from 2014 onwards, we started getting a bunch of them. Like every year, 50 families, 60 families. Right now, we have about 264 families, if I'm right, Rohingya families, registered in our database, who are seeking constant help from us.
The Islamic Circle works to provide basic needs like food, transportation, and medical assistance for Muslim refugees from all over the world, including the Rohingya, who are being forced out of Myanmar. They've been described as the world's most persecuted minority. A UN official has called it ethnic cleansing, and many face some of the tallest barriers. Again, Zaid Hussein.
One of the important main challenge dealing with Rohingya is their mindset, since they are not educated.
Still, Hussein finds ways to open doors through education.
So we thought that rather than always helping them through paying their rent and providing them food, why not teach them a skill through which they can stand on their own legs?
While some refugees take classes at the Islamic Circle, others pave their own path. 20-year-old Muhammad Muhammad and his family settled in Dallas a few years ago.
They escaped the persecution that was happening in Burma. Mm-hmm. And they were, I think my dad was like 16 years old. Around there, he went to Malaysia to seek protection for himself because there was a lot of violence going on.
Muhammad was born in Malaysia, but identifies as Rohingya.
My dad don't want me to have life like him, like, you know, doing a hard labor, hard job.
Even when they escaped the violence in Myanmar, the Rohingyas still face discrimination in host countries like Malaysia. All Muhammad wanted was an education. So his father wrote to a resettlement program and made his son's education a priority.
He seek and he write this in paper and he send it every day. He fax them every day.
His family waited for a year and a half.
So one day they get it. The office get it. They call us, say that you have an interview for resettlement in another country. So we went there and the process went up, and then in the 6 month period they told us that we're going to America. They say you're going to USA, and we're all just like, just dream come true.
In the 4 years since his family moved to North Texas, Muhammad learned English, graduated high school, and now he's in college at the University of Texas at Arlington. Still, he's reminded of what's happening in Myanmar. Muhammad's uncle was killed in the most recent violence. Every village destroyed, every house burned down just adds to the grief. Muhammad hopes that one day things will be different for the Rohingya.
Imagine like thousands of people with education, doctors, engineers, political people. How successful will their country be? I look at that way. A peaceful society, you know.
He says he just doesn't want the Rohingya living in fear. In Dallas, I'm Pablo Peña.
What is the best rap song of 1984? How about 2004? Tough question, right? How about this? What would an NBA game look like if a grizzly bear were starting at power forward? Those are the sort of questions that Arturo Torres brings to life. KERA's Hadi Mawagdi reports on how this Garland, Texas native transformed from aspiring artist to illustrator of two New York Times bestsellers.
Arturo Torres has drawn everyone in rap and basketball. His comic book style portraits get shoutouts from LeBron James, Kobe Bryant, and Chance the Rapper. The 27-year-old's art is featured on ESPN's Grantland and The Ringer. Nike and Google hire him to design interactive murals. And he's illustrated two best-selling books. But fame, money, and accolades are simply part of a larger goal.
The thing is like, for the longest time, I was just afraid of becoming my neighborhood or, like, becoming, like, my father. And so my thing that I had in life was I wanted to change the definition of my last name.
It goes back to his childhood.
And so, like, in the neighborhood that I grew up in, what does Taurus look like? So if you were to ask somebody, it'd be like, oh, it's a broken home. It's an alcoholic father. It's a single mom. You know, it's that.
As a kid, Torres was constantly surrounded by conflict. Outside his home, he saw neighbors selling drugs and getting into fights. And things weren't better inside either.
I began drawing as a way to escape just because there was domestic violence inside my house.
His drawing started off pretty simple. Mickey Mouse and other children's characters. But then Torres turned his attention to comic books.
So it was one of those things where, like, I would use it to ignore everything that was going on. Like, just replicating comic books. If I didn't like the ending to a comic book, I would do the whole thing from scratch and change the ending. And sometimes, like, the villain would be my dad and, like, Spider-Man's rescuing us and stuff like that.
Eventually, Torres's family moved to a shelter for domestic violence. And art became an even bigger outlet.
My counselor saw that that was the way that I was coping with all of this. So she saw that and she encouraged that. She bought me like my first set of art supplies. And so, like, definitely shout out to Genesis because they're the reason why I draw.
Torres saw art as a way towards a better future. But he says even his own family had a problem with that.
If you're in the hood, man, and you tell people, it's like, oh, I don't want to live in this place anymore. Like, they're like, what's wrong with this place? Like, you're seen as the outcast. Like, oh, you think you can be better than this? You think you're better than everyone else?
Torres figured he could stay put or he could hustle.
He literally was a starving artist for a good while.
That's Torres' best friend, Julio Mendez, and they've known each other since they were 11 years old.
Back in the day, him and I used to just do art in my house, and then we'd find an event, we'd drive to it, make $200, and then that was it. I mean, that was kind of the start of everything.
Torres sold his work at art fairs. He made illustrations for online magazines, and he designed flyers for musicians. One of those flyers ended up changing his life.
I came across a flyer that he did for this group I like called The Outfit Texas.
That's Shea Serrano. Serrano lives in Houston and writes about sports and pop culture. At the time, he was looking for an illustrator for the Rap Yearbook.
I knew whoever drew the flyer was the person I wanted to ask to do the book.
And it was a hit, a New York Times bestseller in 2015. Last year, they partnered again on Serrano's Basketball and Other Things. And once again, it's a bestseller. But Serrano says Torres has an even brighter future.
I think he's one of the best working illustrators in the country. We will eventually get to a point where everybody starts to recognize that. Even now, the difference between the Rap Yearbook and the basketball book, like, it's increased tenfold.
That makes Torres smile because he's one step closer to redefining his name. But he's not satisfied. He wants to draw his own graphic novels, and he wants to start his own family. So he's got his future sketched out, and he can see it, but he still has to color it in. I'm Hadi Mawagdi for Fronteras.
Thanks for joining us this week on Fronteras. You can find the show under the Programs tab on our website, tpr.org, and wherever you get your podcasts. Norma Martinez produced the broadcast. Our executive producers are Steve Short and Fernando Ortiz. Our digital editor is Vince Kong. Charanga Cakewalk composed our theme music. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio in San Antonio.